And our study this evening is on life and character studies, and the particular characters are Lot and his family. And Brother Paul Southgate is to give us that address. He has not asked for a reading, so I'll ask Brother Paul to come forward and give us that address, please.
Well, good evening, dear brothers and sisters. We're first introduced to Lot in Genesis chapter 11, where the family tree of Abraham is described. And in Genesis chapter 11, reading from verse 27. This is the genealogy of Terah. Terah begot Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. Haran begat Lot. And Haran died before his father Terah in the native land, in Ur of the Chaldeans. So Lot was Abraham's nephew, and given his father Haran apparently died young, the record implies he died before Abraham and his other brother Nahor were themselves married, it is very likely that Abraham developed a special bond with Lot and became almost a father to him in the place of Haran. And of course Abraham at this time had no child of his own, so I'm sure would have been very pleased to have had the young Lot as a companion. And so, as we all know so well, in the course of time, Abraham and his family departed their hometown of Ur on that long journey westward toward Canaan. Terah died at Haran in Syria, to the north of the Promised Land. And after his passing, Abraham, Sarah, and Lot were further obedient to God's command and pushed on from the relative comforts of Haran down deeper into Canaan. We don't know much about Lot, really, about his young days. His name means concealed or dark-coloured in Hebrew. And although evidently younger than Abraham, he was probably no youth when he set out from Haran. Abraham was, after all, 75, so Lot was probably middle-aged by this time. The next time we hear about Lot is in chapter 13, verse 5. Lot also, who went to Abraham, had flocks and herds and tents. By this stage, both he and Abraham had grown very prosperous, both possessing great amounts of livestock. And indeed, it came to a point where the resources of the land of Canaan, could not support the combined herds of Abraham and Lot, so their herdsmen became locked in a dispute over grazing rights. Clearly, this was not a sustainable situation. Something had to give. The comment there in verse 7 that the Canaanites and the Perizzites then dwelt in the land perhaps indicates that the quarrelling relatives were putting themselves at some kind of risk in a potentially hostile environment by being seen to be arguing. Apart from security considerations, Abraham seemed to appreciate that it was unseemly for him and Lot to be seen arguing over a land that God had promised them. So in verses 8 to 9, he proposes that he and Lot must separate. So Abraham said to Lot, "Please let there be no strife between you and me and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brethren. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If you take the left, then I will go to the right, or if you go to the right, then I will go to the left." These terms, these very generous terms, show that just how great and self-sacrificing a man Abraham was. As the elder, and to whom God had personally given the promise, Abraham could be forgiven for asserting his right to first choice of pasture. But no, his gracious offer to Lot was, "You take what you want first, and I will take what remains." It would appear from verse 3 of this chapter that Abraham and Lot were standing on a mountain between Bethel and Hai, facing north, overlooking the Jordan Valley, when Abraham made this offer to Lot. And from this vantage point, Lot would have been able to see down into the lush and fertile plains beneath him, with the cities of the plain Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, and Zeboim visible. Lot was naturally attracted to this view. After all, as a farmer, who wouldn't? The land was fertile, with plenty of good grazing, and the cities offered security and a steady market for his animal products. Lot may have seen the opportunities of a more settled life, perhaps exchanging stock rearing for arable farming and enjoying the culture and pleasures that proximity to urban centres bring. On the face of it, Lot's choice was perfectly understandable and logical. Who of us, if we were in Lot's shoes and without the benefit of hindsight, would have done any differently? The prospects of a fertile, populated and developed valley are always going to be easier than the lonely, austere life of a nomadic herder on a harsh, barren mountain range. So Lot parted from Abraham and, no doubt, well pleased with his choice, began the long descent down into the Jordan Valley, where he and his company made camp outside Sodom. But it wasn't just the terrain that was going downhill. For we read in verse 13, "But the men of Sodom were exceedingly wicked and sinful against the Lord." Who knows whether Lot was aware of this when he made his choice, but the contrast between him and his uncle could not have been greater. For Abraham was left standing on the lonely mountain, far above the sin and depravity of Sodom. He chose the opposite path, the one that led to Bethel, the house of God, whereas Lot turned towards Ai, which means ruin. Surely, how significant were those meanings of those towns. And it's also significant that God appeared again to Abraham just after Lot had departed from him, reinforcing his promise to give the land to him. This surely was a reward for his selflessness and to bolster his faith after losing the company of the nephew that he had been with for so many years. The next we hear of Lot, he's in big trouble. Years had gone by and the political situation had soured in the Jordan Valley. A confederacy of kings from around the area of Babylon, way back around the Fertile Crescent to the east, had invaded the land and fought with the kings of the cities of the Jordan Plain. Evidently the locals had the worst of it, as we read in Genesis 14 that the cities of the plain became subject to the northern invaders. Verse 4 of 14. 12 years they served Chedorlaomer, that's the leader of this Babylonian confederacy, and in the 13th year they rebelled. 12 years of occupation, unsurprisingly, led to resentment that festered against the occupation and no doubt the tribute that the cities had to pay their foreign overlords. A rebellion by the people of the plain broke out the following year, but was crushed with the arrival of these Babylonian kings after a further year. This time the invaders were more brutal. They came to punish, not to occupy and exploit. Most of the armies of Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. The population either fled to the mountains or was taken captive by the vengeful invaders, who also plundered and destroyed the fabric of the cities. Lot, who by this time is revealed as living in Sodom, did not escape and was taken captive. And of course we know very well how Abraham rode to the rescue of Lot and almost miraculously recovered both him and his other captives and the plunder from the from the kings of Babylon. There's some interesting questions to ponder about this incident. Firstly, Lot's move into Sodom. Was that a temporary move to seek shelter from the invaders that he would have no doubt heard were coming? Or had he moved in permanently years before? We don't know, but he was obviously prosperous as he had goods to plunder, perhaps suggesting the latter. Surely the whole affair should have been a wake-up call, both to the wicked people of the plain and more specifically, Lot himself. The destruction by the Babylonian armies was merely a foretaste of what God himself would do even more thoroughly in the near future. And paradoxically, it was Abraham's actions in riding to the rescue of Lot and attacking the invaders that gave Sodom and Gomorrah a second opportunity. He returned as a conqueror, restoring freedom and prosperity to the people of Sodom. But we remember, of course, how he turned down the offer of reward from the king of Sodom. He knew indeed how wicked he was and the city and the system that he represented. He would have nothing to do with him, but instead resorted to Melchizedek, the king of Salem, high up in the mountains, and of course, a clear type of Christ. So now we must turn to the final chapter in the recorded history of Lot, his last terrible night in Sodom, where we will base the bulk of our remarks on tonight. We don't need to retell this story. We all know it very well, and it was the subject of a recent Bible class by Brother Graham Lake. So we'll just concentrate on the character, really, of Lot and how he so much is revealed about him in these events. And also, we'll look at his family members who we are introduced to for the first time in this chapter 19. So we know the story very well, that these two angels in chapter 18 appeared to Abraham, told him that they were going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, and how Abraham pleaded with them to spare the city on the account of Lot's righteousness, and how the number he negotiated down from 50 down to 10. And it's certainly telling, isn't it, that there weren't even 10 righteous people in Sodom, because had there been, the city would not have been destroyed. The two angels sent to judge Sodom then came upon Lot sitting in the gate at evening time, chapter 19 and verse 1. This is interesting that they met him at the gate of Sodom. We may recall that the gatehouse of an ancient city often acted as a centre of judgment and administration. For example, we think of Boaz going up to the gate of Bethlehem to settle the matter with his kinsman Redeemer. And it was a centre of sort of legal processes. This suggests that Lot may have been active in the administration of Sodom, perhaps as a magistrate or such like. And the sarcastic rebuff later on in verse 9 of the Sodomites to Lot's appeal for reason supports this theory. They said, "This one came in to sojourn, and he keeps acting as a judge." If so, this suggests that Lot was fully integrated into the life of Sodom. But on the other hand, it is also very clear that he had not abandoned his faith in God. Turn forward to the second letter of Peter. Peter here makes a very interesting commentary upon Lot. Second of Peter, chapter 2, verse 6. Talking of various judgments that God meted out on the world in the past, Peter says in verse 6, "And turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly, and delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed with the filthy conduct of the wicked. For that righteous man dwelling among them tortured or tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds." Fundamentally, Lot appears to have been a well-meaning and godly man, but a weak and indecisive character. On the one hand, we see from Peter's commentary how deeply he was disturbed by the society that he lived in. But on the other hand, he enjoyed the material and social comforts that it provided. If he was indeed some kind of a magistrate, perhaps he naively thought that he could influence the city's morals for good. Such efforts were wasted, however, and merely earned Lot the hatred and contempt of his fellow citizens as was evident when the men of Sodom surrounded his house to try and get at the angels he was sheltering inside. This conflict within Lot's mind must have caused a great mental strain. He was vexed by what he saw around him. His conscience must have been telling him to leave and rejoin Abraham in the pure, clear mountains. But to do so would have meant giving up everything he had worked for over many, many years, in particular his family. And so, as Peter says, his soul was tormented every day by what he saw around him. He was oppressed. He was not a happy man. His mind was tortured. And all really because of his indecision and weakness. Well, so much for Lot, but let's think of a little bit about his wife. It's not stated in Scripture whether Lot married his wife before or after he parted from Abraham. But the absence of any mention of her beforehand suggests that he met her in Sodom. This meant, of course, that she was very at home in the city and would have been very unlikely to ever want to leave her friends, family, and the comforts of her home city for the uncertain, hard life of a nomadic shepherd. We'll come back a little bit more to say a little bit more about Lot's wife later on. To sum up, Lot knew what he should have done, which was to leave Sodom and, if necessary, his family behind. But he was in too deep in Sodom and was too weak a character to be able to do that of his own accord. A compromised man, an unhappy man. But of course, one day his life was to change forever. He was to have decisions that he should have made earlier, made for him. And as perhaps we know ourselves from our own experience, having a decision forced on you by others is never quite as nice as making that decision yourself. It means that you are no longer in control. Others are controlling you. Sometimes, of course, that's very necessary in our lives in the truth. What we call providence means that God is directing us, and sometimes he has to force us to do things, doesn't he? If we're being a bit stubborn or obstinate, he will arrange circumstances that we are compelled to go down a certain path, perhaps a certain path that we should have chosen for ourselves long before. And that was certainly the case for Lot. When he saw those two angels walking up to the city gate, they of course looked like men. But perhaps he could tell straight away that they were different from the Sodomites the moment he saw them that fateful evening. We read in verse 1 of chapter 19 that he rose to meet them. He bowed himself with his face towards the ground. Yes, perhaps an Eastern courtesy, but perhaps he wouldn't have extended that to someone that he thought wasn't worthy of it. He saw that they were different, that they were strangers. Perhaps he thought they were a little naive, perhaps vulnerable, and that would explain his eagerness and insistence on inviting them to his own house. He certainly wanted to protect them from the wickedness and violence of the city that they would have been subjected to had they spent the night in the open square. But perhaps also he longed for their company. Perhaps he could tell they were in some way spiritual, and he wanted to converse with them. And so they came to his house, and he baked bread and gave them a feast. But the men of Sodom quickly learned where those two strangers were lodging, and all those in Lot's house were soon left in no doubt about their preference for how they would like to get to know them, as it were. Perhaps these two angels, it's not difficult to imagine them perhaps being particularly fine specimens of manhood in their appearance on the earth, and so they aroused the base and vile passions that Sodom was famous for. Lot's attempts to reason with his townsfolk while showing a degree of bravery reveals how he still clung to the mistaken belief that he could persuade them to change their evil ways. Verse 4. Now before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both old and young, all the people from every quarter surrounded the house. And they called to Lot and said to him, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us, that we may know them carnally." So Lot went out to them through the doorway, shut the door behind him, and said, "Please, my brethren, do not do so wickedly." Yes, he was appalled by their behavior, by their licentiousness, but he still referred to them as his brothers. He still felt that he had some affinity with them, and he thought that he could be an influence for good on them. And then the fact in the next verse that he offered up his own virgin daughters as substitute playthings to the mob shows how desperate he was to appease, while showing a shocking disregard for the welfare of his own offspring, whom he was prepared to sacrifice in an attempt to protect his guests. This really, it puzzles me in a way how a man who was described as righteous and who was so troubled by what he saw around him could yet even think about doing that sort of thing to his own children. It's quite shocking, isn't it? It shows how contorted and confused Lot's mind was. But his appeals merely stoked up the anger of the crowd, who may well have killed him had the angels not intervened to pull back Lot inside before striking the men with blindness. And they retorted with that retort that we'd said about earlier, "This one came in to sojourn, but he keeps acting as a judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with them." The mob's words and actions show how they held Lot in complete contempt, despite his no doubt well-intentioned but naive efforts to try to reform them. And so the angels then, of course, go on to explain the purpose of their visit to destroy Sodom for its wickedness. They pleaded with Lot to show leadership for once and gather his family and take them out of the city before it was too late. Verse 12, and the men said to Lot, "Have you anyone else here, son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, and whomever you have in this place? Take them out of this place." Perhaps it's noteworthy that his wife is not mentioned. Did the angels foresee her fate? Did they realize that she was beyond redemption? It's interesting, isn't it, that the angels mentioned your sons. We don't know whether... We'd assume that being angels, they would have been all-seeing, all-knowing. But yet they ask a question, have you got any other family here? Perhaps they didn't know. Did Lot have sons? We don't know. He might have done, or it might just be a sort of catch-all phrase asked by the angels, as they didn't fully know Lot's family. Anyway, that's perhaps an aside. Lot seemed at last stirred into action and goes to visit his sons-in-law. We can assume these men were just engaged to his daughters, who were still living at home, and as we saw, were still virgins. The meaning of the word married here is betrothed. It's a bit like the situation where Joseph was described as Mary's husband, even before they were actually formally married. Alternatively, I suppose it's possible that Lot had two other married daughters who had left home and lived with their husband, but I think that's probably unlikely. But whatever, Lot's warnings fell on deaf ears. His sons-in-law simply thought he was talking sensational nonsense and laughed him off. If only they knew they were shutting off their only hope of rescue from the destruction that brooded over their hometown. And in some ways, they're perhaps a little bit like in the parable of the sower that Jesus gave, a little bit like the seed that fell on hard ground, completely infertile, and just completely dismissed any hope of salvation or redemption. Again, we perhaps think, had Lot talked to his sons-in-law about his beliefs, about his moral concerns for the city? We don't know, do we? Perhaps he hadn't, perhaps he had. But whatever, Lot's sons-in-law were lost forever. Well, we can only imagine how tense that night was in Lot's household. Did any of them sleep? Unlikely, I should imagine. Lot, his wife and their daughters must have spent a restless night turning over in their heads the sentence upon Sodom delivered by the angels. And at first light, the angels tried to hurry Lot along. Verse 15. The angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, "Arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city." But true to character, Lot dithered, even though he knew the destruction that hung over his city. Verse 16 says he lingered. He was undecided what he should do. He must have believed the angels. He must have known that God was very displeased with the conduct of Sodom. But yet he couldn't quite bring himself to leave it. This seems incomprehensible, doesn't it? So what he must have believed the angels' warning, as we said. So what did he possibly have to gain by delaying? He knew all his property and possessions were about to be destroyed. He couldn't surely have thought that he could have saved anything. The only explanation is that surely his wife and daughters didn't believe the angels and were refusing to move. Lot, perhaps bravely but certainly foolishly, prevaricated in the hope of persuading his family. They were only saved by the angels' decisive action in manhandling all four of them out of their home and their city. Something that he should have done years ago, or certainly should have done on his own volition that morning, he was in the end forced to do. Otherwise, it's doubtful that Lot would have moved. God took mercy on Lot, and by extension his family, despite all his wickedness. Despite all his weakness. And I think we can take great comfort from this, can't we, brothers and sisters, that God will never allow the righteous to be destroyed along with the wicked. That was made very clear when Abraham was pleading with the angels on Sodom's behalf before they met Lot. Abraham appealed to God, saying how righteous he was and that he wouldn't destroy the righteous with the wicked. And we can think about it in Noah's time, how that when God punished the whole world, yet Noah and his family were saved because of Noah's righteous acts. And we can think the same of us too, can't we? How in our day that God, whatever happens to us, we will, certainly in the long run, if we do what is right, be saved and given the great gift of eternal life. That is something that God will never take away from us if we do our part faithfully. But returning to Lot, despite being shown all this mercy and forbearance, Lot's faith was still almost unbelievably weak. Once outside Sodom, he argued with the angels' instructions to flee to the mountains. Verse 17, it came to pass when they had brought them outside that he said, "Escape for your life, do not look behind you, nor stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be destroyed." Clear enough, urgent enough. But then Lot argues. Lot said to them, "Please know, my lords." What does he want now? You can imagine the angels almost being exasperated with him. He reveals himself as being more worried about unspecified dangers in the natural world than the wrath of God. He says, "I cannot escape to the mountains, lest some evil overtake me and I die." Well, what did he think was going to happen to him if he stayed in the plain? It almost beyond belief, isn't it? Lot's attitude. His solution was escape to the nearby city of Zoar, literally meaning little city nearby, for refuge. Perhaps Lot was thinking his wife might be happier in even a small city than living as a refugee in the mountains. He might have thought that he could start again in Zoar after he had done after the Babylonian war, or even that one day Sodom would be rebuilt and life could return to normal for him. He was to be sorely disappointed, of course. For as Lot and his family entered Zoar, again the angels being very, very generous and kind to him, and allowing him, indulging him this request, God's judgments thundered down on Sodom and Gomorrah. The fire and brimstone fell. The land turned to burning pitch, destroying every living being, mankind, animals, and plant life. It was too much for Lot's wife. Her world, perhaps the only world she'd ever known, the only world she wanted, was being destroyed. She could only think of the past, as she had no faith, or no longing for the salvation that could have awaited her had she obeyed God. She just couldn't help a longing backward glance to her old life, in defiance of the angel's clear command not to look back. And of course she paid for that look with her life. She was, again, a hopeless case. A woman of the world who had no interest in obeying God, no desire to please him, no interest in anything spiritual. And so she died, never to rise again. Lot and his daughters didn't stay long in Zoar. It would seem that that city alone survived a cataclysm that fell on the plain that day. But Lot was afraid to stay there. Perhaps afraid that God would revisit his wrath upon Zoar, or simply because he, Lot, was seen by the inhabitants as in some way to blame for what had happened to the region. For sure, life would never be the same again. The agriculture and economy of the cities of the plain had been destroyed. So Lot belatedly obeyed the call to flee to the mountains. Yes, he had to do what God told him to do in the end. It was just such a tragedy that it took him so long to do it. He went there almost as if you can say being dragged, kicking and screaming. And what a miserable state he was now in. Verse 30. Then Lot went up out of Zoar and dwelt in the mountains, and his two daughters were with him, for he was afraid to dwell in Zoar, and he and his two daughters dwelt in a cave. Yes, what a come down. From a settled, prosperous, and at least outwardly respected urbanite, Lot was reduced to a miserable old man living in a mountain cave. He had lost almost everything, his wife, his home, all his material possessions. Just his two daughters were left to him, and they now take center stage in the final chapter of Lot's story. The firstborn said to the younger, "Our father is old, and there is no man on earth to come into us, as is the custom of all the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we will lie with him, that we may preserve the lineage of our father." Well, even allowing for the culture they grew up in, where preserving the family line was all important, the actions of Lot's daughters in tricking their father into incest in order to have children is pretty sordid. No doubt they were traumatized. Their hopes for a settled, prosperous life with their future husbands had been shattered. They must have realized they had no prospects, and the only available male was their own father. Even so, their actions surely can only reflect poorly on their characters. I'm sure the immorality of the city that they had been brought up in must have rubbed off on them. There is somewhat of a parallel between this and the incident of Noah's drunkenness when his son Ham looked on his father's nakedness and was cursed for it. And surely Ham perhaps only accidentally looked at his father's nakedness, carelessly. But to do what Lot's daughters did was premeditated and very much planned. There is a bitter irony that the man who was willing to see his daughters abused to protect himself ended up being abused by those same daughters. And the offspring of these two incestuous unions became the ancestors of the Moabites and the Ammonites, two peoples who were to become among Israel's most bitter enemies in the future. And perhaps again there's a lesson here that Lot's daughters tried to pervert the course of nature and paid for it by, if you like, creating monsters that were opposed to God's will and opposed to his people. So this was Lot's legacy. Rather than sharing a bright future with God, chosen seed, Abraham, Lot chose to go his own way, make his own life in an environment estranged from God. Lot was a weak, indecisive man, a compromised man, a man who put, even though he knew the truth, if you like, knew God's will, he put the pleasure and comfort of this life in front of God's promises to him. He knew what God required of him, and while his personal life may indeed have been righteous, he compromised his walk before God to make his life in this world easier. Well, I'm sure the lessons for us are clear. We live in a society like Sodom, where material gain is all important and people largely ignore God's principles and live by their own moral code. Unlike Lot, however, we are not commanded to physically leave this environment, but we must distance ourselves from its morals and ideals. In the world, but not of it, and strangers and pilgrims in this present world, looking for that better world to come. Like Abraham, we must live differently from the ways of the people that we live among. And while perhaps what we see around us does cause us sadness and despair, if we are distanced from it mentally, we don't need to worry, do we? We know that God, we have faith that God will protect us and bring us to his kingdom, whatever we see going on around us. And as for Lot's wife, well, God forbid that any of us should be like her, completely godless, putting all her hopes and faith in this current wicked world and paying that terrible price for looking back to it. And when Jesus does come, of which, by the way, the appearance of the angels to Lot is clearly a type, isn't it? And the judgment of Sodom is clearly a type of the judgments on our world. Our priorities and affections now will very much inform our reaction to the call to go and meet Christ. If Christ came this evening, would we be like Lot, dithering, not really wanting to leave behind this comfortable life that we have in Britain? Perhaps thinking we could have the best of both worlds, would we try and take any of our material possessions with us? Or would we, dare say, even be like Lot's wife, who looked back with sorrow at the world that she was leaving behind? Well, surely not, brothers and sisters. We all want to be like Abraham, don't we? Who was assured of the promises, who lived as a stranger and a pilgrim in the land. But yet he believed God. He knew that God would one day bring to pass his great promises that he'd made to him. He embraced them, and he was obedient when he was asked to leave his homeland and ventured out into the unknown. And when in the land of Canaan, he patiently sojourned there, waiting for that day that surely is very future, very soon now, when he will take possession of that land. And may God bless each of us with a place with Abraham in the kingdom.